Very warm welcome to the December RSS Journal Club. My name is John Aston from the Department of Statistics at University of Warwick, and I'm very pleased to be chairing this Journal Club. The Journal Club is sponsored by Quintiles, and we very much thank them for their support. If you haven't got a copy of the presentation slides so far, they are available from the website rss.org.uk/journalclub, and our authors today will make reference to which particular slide they're looking at as they go through so that you can follow along with the Journal Club. This webinar is going to be recorded, and the podcast is going to be posted to the RSS Journal Club webpage so that you can listen again as much as you like after the event. And we'd like to remind you, if possible, to mute yourself when you're not talking, so that will prevent feedback. And but if you would like to ask questions, particularly at the end of the presentation, if you dial *6 into your telephone keypad, that should unmute yourself. And if you dial *6 again, then you will mute yourself again. And I think you can mute yourself and unmute yourself on the computer using the button provided. For questions at the end of the presentation, there's a web conferencing option, which means that you can type your questions into the question box, and it will be sent back here, and we can use those questions at the end of the presentation, or at the end of the presentation, you'll be more than welcome to ask your questions through either the phone or your voice on your computer. If you'd like to get feedback, then you can have your name and address, but we won't share this with anyone else. So it's my very great pleasure to welcome Patrick Perry and Patrick Wolfe, who are going to be presenting our Journal Club today. It's from JRSSB, and it's the paper Point Process Modeling for Directed Interaction Networks. Patrick Perry is Assistant Professor of Statistics in the Information Operations and Management Sciences Department at NYU Stern in the US. His main research area is modern multivariate statistics, and specifically he focuses on inference for network data and other emerging data sources. He's also interested in high-dimensional data analysis and random matrix theory. Our second presenter is going to be Patrick Wolfe, who's the Professor of Statistics at the University College London and currently leads a large US multidisciplinary university research initiative on the statistical analysis of graphs and social networks. He's a UK Royal Society Research Fellow and also an EPSRC Mathematical Sciences Research Fellow. You're more than welcome, remember, to ask questions at the end of the talk. And with that, I'm very pleased to hand over to Patrick and Patrick.
All right, thanks for that introduction, John. I'm Patrick Perry, and here's my colleague.
Patrick Wolfe, back to you.
Okay, so the way this is going to work is I'm going to talk for a little bit, then turn it over to Patrick Wolfe, and then I'll do a little bit of conclusion after that. So the motivation for this work is the explosion of data in the social sciences in the last 5 years. And what's happening in the social sciences is what happened to biology starting in the 90s, in that the availability of data has increased by orders of magnitude. And this explosion of data has really broadened the scope of the types of questions that social scientists can ask and answer. And there's tremendous promise for getting a better understanding of human behavior. So as Lazare and colleagues pointed out in a Science editorial in 2009, whenever two people exchange an email or make a phone call, when someone swipes a transit card or makes a purchase with a credit card or does any sort of digital activity, there's a record of this, and there's potential for collecting all these activities into data sets, and by analyzing these data sets, we can get some insight into the behaviors of social systems. And so this work was about trying to figure out what sort of information is available in interaction data and whether or not we can tease this information out through some statistical modeling. And so now I'm going to move on to slide 3. This is the broad overview of the work. The main theme is to take raw interaction data, use a point process model to understand the data better, and by doing so, we'll gain some insight into the behavior of a social system. And by insight, I mean we're going to try to learn which traits and behaviors are predictive of interaction. So moving on to a specific example of this in slide 4, the data set we consider is an email communication network that comes from the Enron Corporation. As many of you will remember, Enron was an energy trading company that was investigated in the early 2000s for accounting fraud. And as part of this investigation, the United States Justice Department subpoenaed the email correspondences between the top executives at the company. And now one of the great accidents of social science research is that this data has become public domain, and it's a great test bed for both developing methodology for interaction data and also gaining some insight into corporate email behavior around the early 2000s. And so the specifics of the Enron data set are that we have roughly 156 employees sending messages to each other over a 3-year period. They send approximately 21,000 messages. And the data consists of a series of files, each representing an email. The file has some header information, including the date and time the message was sent, the sender of the message, the recipient of the message, along with the text of the message. Okay, and now slide 5. When you try to visualize this data set, you quickly realize how difficult it is to get any sort of insight into the communication behavior. So what I'm showing here on slide 5 is a screenshot from a tool Jeff Heer built in 2004 specifically for visualizing the Enron email data. What he's showing you on the left panel is a node for each employee and an edge linking the two employees if they've ever exchanged messages. And basically, what you can see is that it's hard to really get any sort of insight into what's going on. So sort of simple visualization techniques alone fail when you're looking at a network on this scale. And to really tease out information, you need to do some modeling. All right, so that brings me to slide 6, which is the specific question we're going to try to get at by use of modeling, which is we're going to try to learn which traits and behaviors are predictive of email sending. So specifically for each employee, we have measured some traits, including the gender, the seniority, and the department of the employee. So for example, we have 43 female executives and 113 male executives. And we're going to ask which of these traits and which behaviors are predictive of interaction. And by interaction, I mean message sending. All right, now slide 7. The raw data, as we conceive it, is a series of time-stamped events, and each event comes with a time, T, a sender, I, and a receiver, J. And two things to note about the raw data is that these are events that occur in continuous time at the resolution of a second, and these are instantaneous events. These are messages. These are not links or relationships that persist in time. So now, slide 8, the way we're going to think about this data is that they are generated from a point process, and specifically for each sender-receiver pair, IJ, we have an axis indexed by time, and whenever person I sends person J a message, there's a blip or an orange event on this axis. So our goal is going to be to try to understand this point process. And we're going to get at it using something called the stochastic intensity, lambda t of ij. And heuristically, lambda t of ij is a quantity that, when multiplied by a small amount dt, tells us the probability that person I is going to send a message to person j in the next time instant. Okay, so moving on to some specifics in slide 9, we have these employee-specific traits. The department, the seniority, and the gender. And we can encode these traits in 4 binary variables. So for example, L of I is 1 or 0 depending on whether or not actor I is in the legal department. And we're going to be modeling the process on the level of pairs of individuals. So our covariates are going to depend on the traits of the sender and the traits of the receiver. So if we look at the interactions between the actor-specific traits, We have four traits plus an intercept for the sender, four traits for the receiver. There are 20 total interactions between these. We're going to encode these traits into a vector x of ij. And our goal is to try to understand which of these traits are associated with sending behavior. And to talk specifically about how we're going to model that association, I'm going to turn things over to my colleague, Patrick Wolf.
Thanks, Patrick. So moving on to slide 10, I'm going to start by describing the sort of baseline approach that we took. And as you can see from the title of the slide, our first attempt to model these data is just a basic Cox proportional intensity model. So we have the stochastic intensity lambda t on the left of the equation that's listed, and it's decomposed into a baseline time-varying rate that's specific to each sender in the network that gets modeled non-parametrically and then modulated up and down according to the action of a vector of these covariates, x, and a corresponding vector of coefficients, beta. So the important thing to understand here is that the observables come in the form of message counts, time-stamped message counts, and we're interested in explaining how the covariates and the observables can help to explain the interactions that we see. So moving on to slide 11, you'll see that immediately with this baseline approach, there's a problem, and the problem is sparsity. So we've picked as an example a particular sender in this data set, Tanya J, and we've listed the counts of all messages from Tanya in the entire time frame of the email list, and what you see is that it's pretty sparse, but the messages predicted by the model are not. And this is simply because the shared effects that Patrick Perry mentioned a couple of slides ago are sparse in a different way than the message patterns that we observe. So this sort of indicates to us that we're going to need to take into account other things in our modeling if we're going to be successful. And perhaps the most natural thing to think about as a next step is to begin to incorporate time dependency into this analysis. So in other words, if you don't know anything else about Tanya J, you can probably reasonably imagine that how her email behavior is today or during the past week is pretty predictive of what her email behavior is going to be like tomorrow. And so we'll quantify that notion, turning now to slide 12, through the introduction of something that we call network effects. And network's effects are just exactly that, taking into account the interchange, the past history of interactions, both between particular senders and receivers, and also between senders and receivers indirectly as a consequence of third parties. And so I'll speak a little bit about each of the network effects that's listed in the slide here, and I'll begin by turning to slide 13 to do this. So the way that we'll do this is we will imagine that at a given time t, we divide the infinite past into a series of intervals. So it superscript 1 would be, for example, the past half an hour. And it superscript 2 would be, for example, the past, 30 to 180 minutes, and so on and so forth. And then what we'll be able to do is tabulate the counts of past sent and received messages as a function of senders I and receiver J in each of these time intervals, where the time intervals are now indexed by K. And this is going to be the basic approach that allows us to do much better in terms of predictive modeling in this context. So we'll take a look at that in a minute, but first I'm going to move on to slide 14 and just point out to you that there are other possible network effects that can be included, so-called triadic effects that involve the exchange of pairs of messages relative to senders and receivers, integrated out or sort of summed out over all other people in the network. And I've just listed a few of those here as examples, and more details can be found in the paper. So if I now turn to slide 15, we arrive at the final statement of our model. So it looks very much like your standard Cox proportional intensity model, the only difference being now that this vector of covariates x is allowed to depend on time. So now we have a vector x of t of time-varying covariates as a function of each sender in the network I and each receiver in the network j. So that's the final model. We've listed a couple of references at the bottom of the slides as to other people who have looked at related approaches. And again, those things are detailed in the paper for those of you who are interested. So given that this is the final model, our question then becomes, what are we able to say methodologically about this model? And the main answer is given on slide 16, which I'll turn to now. And it is as follows. Under sort of standard likelihood-based regularity conditions, as the number of messages n grows large, then we're able to consistently estimate the vector beta that tells us how large the various covariate effects are in this model. And moreover, not only can we consistently estimate beta, but it's asymptotically normal, and its covariance structure can also be consistently estimated. The basic idea here goes back to Cox from 1975, and about 7 years later, Anderson and Gill showed a more formal proof of this type of result in the context of survival analysis. So you might have recognized the model that we've talked about from survival analysis, but I want to make the point that the context here is a little bit different. In traditional survival analysis, we would imagine that our study consists of a fixed time interval, and we look at the number of individuals who need to be included in the study in order to guarantee reasonable inference. So we're almost doing the opposite in this setting. We are perhaps fixing the number of people in the network, and instead we're letting time go to infinity such that the number of messages n grows large. So we're looking at a different large sample limit than would traditionally be done. So now I'm going to turn to slide 17, and I'm going to talk about an important next step, and that is to realize that most emails might be between just two individuals, but it's also possible to send an email that has more than one recipient. And it's very natural to take these multiple recipient emails and break them into, in this example, three pieces. So an email sent from Alice simultaneously to Bob, Carol, and Dan could be broken into three pairwise emails, one from Alice to Bob, one from Alice to Carol, and one from Alice to Dan. If we do this in the context of the email data set that Patrick Perry introduced, we'll find that we increase the total message count by over 50%. And that kind of gives us a hint that we need to be careful when we employ this duplication strategy, because it's probably going to change our likelihood-based analysis. And in fact, that turns out to be true. And so if I move now to slide 18, we'll see that doing this actually introduces a bias. So this result can be quantified as follows. Under, again, standard regularity conditions, if we treat multiple recipient messages via duplication, as I just gave you on slide 17, then we'll introduce a bias that's on the order of 1 over the number of nodes in the network. So the figure on slide 18 has a variance plus bias squared decomposition of the mean squared error. And if you actually look at the figure, you'll see that any one of the green curves, as we follow it to the right, will give you the asymptotic bias. The curves do not decay to zero. But on the other hand, if the number of nodes grows at a rate like root n, we'll recover the dashed black curve, which you can see has a negative slope, indicating that when the order of the number of nodes is growing like the root of the number of messages, the bias will go to zero, and we'll get a consistent estimator. So this can be formalized as we've done in the paper, and the main implication in finite sample settings is that we can use the parametric bootstrap to bias correct in this context. And the results that Patrick Perry will talk about in a minute are done under this finite sample bias correction. So I'll now move to slide 19, and I'll just quickly summarize for you where we are right now before handing it back over to Patrick Perry for the final third of the talk. So the basic idea here is we've taken an example of time-stamped interaction data, We've shown how to conceive of it as sort of like a multivariate point process using a proportional intensity model, and that allows us to bring in various covariates and understand their potential effects. And then we're able to use standard techniques from survival analysis, like maximum partial likelihood, to then get consistent estimates of the parameters. So I'm now going to turn it back over to Patrick Perry, who will finish out the final third of the talk and tell you a little bit about actual data analysis.
Okay, great. So moving on to slide 20, I'm going to talk about what happens when we use this model and these methods to analyze the Enron data set. And just to refresh your memory, we have 156 employees who sent approximately 21,000 messages to each other. We have 20 group-level covariates, things that encode the gender, the seniority, and the department of the actors. And we have 216 network effects, these interval-specific network effects counting behaviors like how many sends, how many receives, how many two sends, etc. And it seems like a lot of covariates, but when we fit this model, it only takes about 15 minutes to fit on a laptop. So moving on to slide 21, recall that when we didn't have the network effects and we looked and we compared the observed message counts from Tanya J with the fitted message counts, the fit wasn't very good. But now we've included network effects and we see the fit agrees very well with the observation. So where we observe zero message counts from Tanya, we typically predict less than one messages from the model. And when we observe many messages from Tanya, our prediction is typically on the same order as the observation. Now, Tanya's just one employee. On slide 22, we'll see what happens when we compare all employees' observed values with their fitted values. On the left of this panel on slide 22, we see a model that does not include network effects. On the right side, we're using a model that does have network effects. On the top, this is a plot of the observed count versus fitted count. And we can see that once we include network effects, we get a very good fit. On the bottom, we have something like a Pearson residual. We take observed minus expected over square root of expected. And again, these Pearson residuals are very well behaved. So we have some confidence that once we've adjusted for the network effects, we have a model that is representative of the data. Now slide 23 shows an analysis of deviance, which gives us the relative contributions of the various terms of the model. And we can see, importantly, that the send and the receive covariates really dramatically reduce the deviance with a small number of degrees of freedom. Adding these sort of second order network effects, the sibling, two send, etc., does decrease the residual deviance, but the gains are marginal. The next thing we see on slide 24, when we investigate the coefficients of the model, this is where we can tease out the associations between the observed traits and the message behavior. And what this table is showing you is the coefficient corresponding to the interaction between the sender covariate and the receiver covariate. So, for example, if we look at the entry corresponding to row 1 and column J, this is the coefficient that corresponds to the sender intercept and the receiver being a member of the junior group. And by looking at the coefficients of this table, we can see the effect the traits have on the baseline rate. And so we can tease out things showing, for example, that junior executives tend to send to junior executives at a higher relative rate than they send to senior executives. Senior executives display the converse behavior. All right. The next thing we see on slide 25 is the associations between the send and receive network effects and the relative sending rate. And for example, we can see that every message J has sent to I in the last 30 minutes is associated with an increase in the relative sending rate by a factor of e to the 1.8, or 6. Okay, and so we see that recent messages have a strong association with increased sending rate, and that this effect decays over time. So messages sent 21 days or longer ago have a minimal effect on the relative sending rate. All right, now slide 25 shows you the estimated coefficients for the triadic effects. Most of these are not significantly different from zero, but one exception for this is the sibling coefficient corresponding to 30 minutes. And what this coefficient is saying is that if person I and J have both received a message from the same individual in the last 30 minutes, then there's a strong association with an increased rate from I to J. All right. Now, slide 26, just to recap what we have learned from the Enron data analysis. So by looking at the trait-specific coefficients, we saw that employees exhibited trait-based homophily. So individuals send to others similar to themselves at a higher rate than they send to different individuals. The second point we observed is that these history-dependent network effects are far more predictive than trait-based effects. And we saw this in the analysis of deviance table, and we saw this also by looking at the residuals. And then the third thing we saw was that the predictive strength of the network effects decays rapidly over time. So messages sent in the last 30 minutes are very predictive. Messages sent 21 days ago were not very predictive. And more broadly, what have we learned from this methodology? Well, we have an approach for taking directed interaction data and teasing out associations between the observed behaviors and the message sending rate. And so this methodology, while we've illustrated it with an email example, it could equally apply to any setting where you observe a time stamp sequence of events between senders and receivers. All right. So this concludes the presentation portion of the talk. I'll turn it over to our chair, John Aston, and we're happy to take questions later.
Well, I'd like to thank both Patricks for a very interesting and stimulating talk. Do we have any questions initially from the floor? If not, then I will kick off the discussion saying, well, one of the interesting things about this is that the Enron network is a closed network. And I was wondering whether, you know, using some of the ideas or from survival analysis to do with things like missing data, and you've got either missing messages that could have been deleted, or you've got missing nodes that may not be in the network, but you could have information coming in and out to nodes that you have no extra information about. And I'm wondering whether you could describe whether the model could be extended to look at that kind of case.
Patrick Wolf, I'll respond first to this comment. So I think it's a very good point, and there's plenty of prior work that kind of flags this issue. In this particular example, we had access to the inboxes and outboxes of these 156 individuals, sort of modulo their personal assistants and so on and so forth. And so actually, we only looked, as you said, at the kind of closed email exchanges that were strictly amongst these 156 individuals. So it's absolutely true that there is more data here that we didn't look at that has messages in the inboxes and outboxes that did not correspond to these 156. So I think there are some interesting things to do there. In particular, we ought to be able to learn something more about things like baseline sending rates on an individual basis. And I'll ask if Patrick Perry wants to follow up a little bit on this. I know this is something that you've thought about as well.
Yeah, so just to add on that, there's really two types of missing data you brought up. So one type is there could be a message sent between two actors in the closed network that we didn't observe. And for the Enron network, certainly we know that that's the case. Some of these messages have been redacted, and some were maybe missed due to processing errors. For that type of missing data, really it's an open question as to how best to handle it. And to be honest, we don't have a great answer for that, and really no one has a great answer for how to handle that type of missing data. The other type of missing data you mentioned is for employees outside of the network, this closed network. What are we to do with that? That case is very much analogous to censoring in the traditional survival analysis context. So the at-risk set in the clinical trial setting corresponds exactly to the observable possible recipients in our setting. So we can model the sort of people at risk of receiving a message exactly the same way that the at-risk set is handled in the clinical trial setting.
Great, thank you. And if you'd like to ask a question, then please do click on the question and answer bubbles at the top of your screen, or alternatively, if you press *6 on your phone, then this should unmute your phone, and then you will be able to ask your question, and then *6 again after speaking will mute your phone again, as it says on the screen. Do we have any questions that people would like to put at this point?
Can I ask a question? Or can't you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely. Apologies, could you repeat your question? We're having a bit of trouble hearing it at this end.
Okay, sorry about that. So you modeled the intensity of the stochastic process. What would happen if you wanted to model the intensity as a conversation but smooth lander, which is not a...
Well, I think we've lost the connection, but I think the idea was that you were asking whether we could model the intensity function lambda in a non-stationary but smooth way as opposed to the way that's currently being modeled. So would you like to...
I think this is getting at what about this baseline rate lambda bar T of I, which we treated as a nuisance parameter, as it is often done in the survival analysis context. And we were only looking at relative rates, relative to the particular sender's baseline. If you had wanted to model absolute rates of exchange, you have to, this is no longer a nuisance parameter, you have to take a look at lambda bar T of I explicitly. And for this, you can adapt some of the techniques that are used in survival analysis. You can look at kernel methods for this. This is something that we're very much interested in doing, but we haven't done it at this stage.
Yeah, so to follow up on that, if you're interested in looking for a postdoc, then get in touch. But seriously, well, that is serious, but to add a few more technical comments, I think this is a very interesting avenue. In some sense, we have right now a nice balance between the kind of model that we elicited and the computation that we're able to do. I mentioned earlier that sort of part of the nice thing of partial likelihood is that this baseline rate sort of gets quotiented out of the analysis. And of course, as Patrick mentioned, there are many cases where you'd like to take it into account. One thing that's interesting to think about, for example, are things like exogenous shocks to the network. So for example, if you look at the marginal counts of Enron email, you see spikes around the time that bad publicity affected the company. And so one could imagine other ways to couple the baseline rates of individuals across the network, and this would probably increase the realism of the model. It may well complicate fitting procedures, but I think it's very reasonable to ask to be able to do that. So right now we kind of have we reached a certain balance between sort of model fidelity and realism and computation, and looking at rebalancing that is going to be important to think about when you consider that in terms of the number of nodes in the Enron network, it's still relatively small at 150. And so if we want to scale up these types of approaches to much larger networks, that may eventually affect what we're able to do in practical terms. So thank you for that question.
Yeah, and actually one thing I wanted to add, I know the Vu paper we cited does look at modeling this baseline rate. And they use, so we stratified on the basis of sender. We allowed each sender to have a different non-parametric sending rate. I believe in their formulation, they do not stratify on sender, and they have more data available to fit the baseline rate. So perhaps if you're interested in those sorts of tools, you could follow up with the VU reference given in the paper and at the end of the slides.
Great.
Thank you very much. Do we have further questions from those listening to the webinar?
Don't be shy, we don't bite.
Well, another question that I had was, you made quite a lot of the fact that the model fit is much, much better when you include the network effects than when you don't. But still you don't get zeros where there are zeros. And it would sort of seem natural in many situations that you might have some kind of zero inflation in your data that would not be expected from. Now, is it possible to build it that into your model so that you have much more realistic, I mean, in terms of zeros, I mean, you get good estimates, which are very close to zero, but they're not zero, and you'd kind of like to know whether there was an interaction between this person or not, rather than a small interaction. You got comments and ideas on how you might incorporate that?
Yeah, so I think, this is Patrick Wolf speaking to start out here. I think, yeah, you mentioned the key word zero inflation, and I think it is very natural in this context. When we think about the asymptotic properties of these families of models, it's important to understand whether we expect an asymptotic regime in which eventually everyone has emailed everyone else, and there's real questions about how realistic this is. The same thing comes up in more sort of standard network analysis where we ask about, is everyone eventually friends with everyone else in Facebook? And clearly somehow the answer should be no, but designing asymptotic regimes that reflect that can be a little bit delicate, and it requires certain choices to be made. But I think the answer is a resounding yes, that taking into account sort of explicit sparsity is at least in certain modeling regimes, is something that's very much warranted. And Patrick has more to add on this point.
Yeah, and this issue also gets at the sort of tension between having a realistic model versus having a model that you can fit efficiently to a large data set. So a lot of our modeling choices were made specifically so that we could fit this to this data set efficiently. It only took us 15 minutes. So that's the reason, for example, for using a multiplicative model instead of an additive model. That was the reason for this specific choice of covariates, which change at certain intervals. If you start to build in things like zero inflation and more exotic link functions and so on, you do get a better model fit, but at the cost of a much more expensive fitting procedure. So it's always a balance. You want the most realistic model you can get, but at the same time you want a model that you can actually fit.
I mean, to add one final point to that, this is Patrick Wolf again. It's also important to remember that we sort of gave our principal objective here as sort of estimating these specific covariate effects. And it's true that probably a lot of the literature in bulk is focused on prediction. And we showed some predictive properties in the slides, but I think it's also an important distinction to think about into this balance or mixture that Patrick Perry brought up. When are we asking and answering very specific scientific questions about, almost in some sense testing for an effect or looking for significance of effects, bases versus something that's maybe more focused on predictive power, that's going to also come into that trade-off. So it's a very good point to bring up, I think.
Do we have further comments?
Questions from the floor?
So I guess one thing that would be not of it, there is a new, is that a question? I think we do have a question.
We're just arranging the email chat to be able to see the questions here.
So the question is from, I believe, from Beatrice Franca. And the question is, out of curiosity, what was the first idea for a nice model using network structure in point processes? And did you look for a nice data set when you found this model, or did it come the other way around? Did you have the data set and you felt you should model it this way? So a very realistic question in a lot of methodological research.
So we actually started out with the data set. And we started out with a much simpler model. We were looking at a very a simple model that didn't include very many covariates at all. And our so it was basically lambda ij is equal to e to the alpha I plus beta j for parameters alpha I and beta j. This is the first thing we considered. And we quickly realized that the model fit was terrible and that using observed covariates didn't help at all. And so we struggled a lot with what to do. And eventually we realized that the time history is this tremendous resource you can use. And the prediction problem for what predicting tomorrow becomes much easier if you're allowed to use what happened in the past. So it was a very much data-driven model building. And that the thinking about the data was what led us to these specific choices of covariates, not the other way around.
Yeah, and Patrick Wolf, to follow on to that, or from that, a very particularly nice feature of this family of proportional intensity models is that you are allowed to regress on past interactions. And so that was another kind of key component, finding a way to, you know, you leverage past interactions and not lose the ability to say concrete things about performance guarantees about fitting the model. In reference to the beginning idea that Patrick Perry mentioned, there's been a little bit of follow-up work in the literature on that model, and extending that model to handle zero inflation is I think, as John mentioned earlier, is pretty straightforward. It doesn't lead, perhaps, to interesting descriptive models, but it might lead to reasonable baseline or null, sort of null models. Probably, if your data is fitted well by that type of model, it's not very interesting, and so that opens the door to doing other things like non-parametric anomaly detection and sort of so on and so forth. So I think those more basic approaches are still valuable, you know, in and of themselves, but maybe for other reasons. And the advantage, of course, is one can do more technical things in that setting because the basic ingredients are much, much simpler. And in a way, it's just very fortunate that in the sort of proportional intensity setting that one can do this sort of endogenous regression in a way that still preserves mathematical structure. So, thank you.
Yeah, and I will point out that we were not the first people to take this point process approach to network data. I believe Carter Butts was the first in roughly 2008. What we were the first to do, though, was recognize the connections between these models and survival analysis models. So both us and the Vu paper recognized simultaneously that there is a connection between these point process, this point process way of thinking about network data and survival analysis data. So you can find, if you look in Butz's paper, he's basically reinvented the Cox model and reinvented partial likelihood without realizing it. So it's a very natural idea, a very natural way to deal with this type of data.
I think that question sort of very naturally leads on to the question, do you feel, you gave some very nice examples of where this model might be applicable in other areas, but do you feel the kind of network effects that you've looked at, particularly for the Enron data, would be the kind of natural network effects you might see in other settings, or do you think you might have to come up with different forms of network effect that might, in order to be able to handle other networks?
Sure, so one other type of interaction data, which I mentioned in the introduction, is so-called bipartite data, where the senders and the receivers are different entities. Now, everything in our theoretical framework handles these types of interactions perfectly fine, But you have to design your covariates a little bit differently. So, for example, transitivity has to be defined in a little bit different way. If your I's are people and your J's are products, it doesn't make sense to have a product send a message to a person. But you can define similar behaviors, and you can see which of these are predictive of interaction. So I think there's a lot of potential for transaction data of this form specifically.
And to follow up on that with a couple of points, Patrick Wolf again. One point is this comes back again to this question about whether our goals are purely predictive or whether they're more about, for example, testing for significance of effects. The other thing that's important to think about is when we use these point process models, we're making an assumption. And one of the assumptions is that the interactions are instantaneous. And of course, that's not true because we can't instantaneously write and compose multiple emails. So if one thinks about the point process framework in particular, one needs to be very careful to think about this issue going forward. So for example, if we wanted to do the same thing for phone calls, for example, at what point would we really seriously need to begin to take duration of a phone call into account, for example? But nevertheless, I think we're seeing a little bit of a second wave in network modeling where we're becoming more and more reluctant to simply reduce complicated networks to sort of static snapshot graphs. And I really like the continuous time aspect of the point process approach. And I think it would be very nice as well to be able to smoothly interpolate between the continuous time point of view and more of a discrete time point of view. And that's something that we explore a little bit in the paper when we compare to other approaches in the literature. But in reference to a previous question about modeling base size intensities as smooth, one can imagine that there is a nice continuum that goes smoothly from kind of continuous time models that we've talked about to things that are more discrete time in nature. And I think there's lots of interesting connections to be made there. And so those were the two points I wanted to make.
Well, do we have any final questions from anyone in the webinar? Well, if not, I would like to thank our two presenters, Patrick and Patrick, again for what's been a fascinating look at network analysis and how this can be done with reference to the Enron dataset, but also, I think, as we've seen, much more generally. I'd also like to thank all of you for dialing in. We hope that you found the session enjoyable and useful, and that maybe these kind of models will be something that you look at in the future. The next RSS Journal Club session will be in March or April of next year, 2014. And as this one was, it will be open to both RSS members and also RSS non-members. We'd very much like to thank our sponsors again, Quintiles, for helping make this Journal Club meeting possible. And the podcast of this Journal Club, along with others, I believe, are all available on the RSS Journal Club webpage, and this particular one will be available shortly. There will be a Professional Statisticians Forum online event in the near future, and the details of this will be able to be found on the RSS website. So thanking Patrick Perry and Patrick Wolf again, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this webinar.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.